Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
This isn't one of those dishes that you want to have the greens crispy and crunchy. It's more of, you know, get that nice mouthfeel, kind of a velvety, creamy mouthfeel.
Daniel Orr has plenty of greens to work with for our recipes today. Neither dish will be a salad, and they both use almost identical ingredients, which is handy. The creative ways small farms are attracting new customers with Harvest Public Media. Healthy dung beetle populations can make a cow pie disappear in a matter of hours, but the number of insects has been declining for decades. We talk spirits with Brad Dunn, specifically the alcohol made from agave plants, and part two of our conversation with two of the authors of the new Bloomington Food Charter. What's happening in the world of food and farming? Luann Johnson with our news.
Cuts of beef tenderized by machines will have to be labeled under a new rule put out this week by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Processing plants use mechanical tenderizers to make tough meat more palatable. The problem is, the needles can push harmful pathogens like E. coli into the middle of the cut of beef, making a rare cooked steak a reason to go to the hospital. Now, all cuts of beef run through a machine that punctures it with needles will need to be labeled. The USDA has estimated that the number of people sickened by E. coli from mechanically tenderized beef could be as high as 4,500 per year. The goal of the new labels is to provide more information to consumers who might be more inclined to cook the meat all the way through to kill any bacteria. The labels will be required on packages of meat starting in May of next year. Water scarcity threatens some of the world's largest food companies, according to a new report. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell has more.
Farming can be a major contributor to water pollution through runoff of chemicals or manure. Food companies rely on clean water, so they have an incentive to help farmers keep water in mind. Ceres, an environmental sustainability group, recently assessed how 35 of America's biggest food companies are engaging farmers on this issue. Brooke Barton co-authored the report. She says most aren't doing enough.
A lot of the food companies are frankly asleep at the wheel. Many have not even begun to look at the water impacts associated with the farmers, the dairies, and the ranches that they source from.
Along with pollution, Ceres cites drought, aquifer depletion, and competition from cities as major reasons for water worries. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
And Indiana beekeepers lost about half of the bees in their colonies this past year, according to a new study from the USDA's Bee Informed Partnership. In 2013, Indiana bee colonies were hit hard. Only about 35% of the bees survived, making Indiana's losses some of the worst in the country. But this past year wasn't as bad. Beekeepers lost about 51% of their bees, slightly higher than the national average. The honeybee population started declining during the 1980s. Some attribute it to a particular breed of Asian mites. Before the mites were found in the U.S., the average winter honeybee loss was between 5 to 10%. Since then, numbers have fluctuated between 30 and 50% losses over a single winter. Dave Shenefield, president of the Indiana Beekeepers Association, says besides the mites, other risks to the honeybees include pesticides and lack of pollinating plants. He adds that proper beekeeper training and genetic developments to help bees fight off the mites have the potential to slow down the decline. More about these stories at eartheats.org, and find stories like these posted on our Twitter feed throughout the week at Earth Eats. Thanks to the team at Harvest Public Media for contributing to our news this week.
Luann Johnson, all the best.
Yep, till next week.
The local food scene has exploded in recent years. That means there's a lot more local produce on dinner tables, but it also means at this time of year, as small farms start ramping back up, they have to work a bit harder to attract new customers. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer discovered farmers are getting creative to stand out from one another.
At Primary Healthcare, a clinic in Ames, Iowa, certified nurse midwife Megan Sloat is seeing a new patient who is pregnant with her first child.
Here in America, we have something called community-supported agriculture, mm-hmm. which is when community members mm-hmm. get vegetables from a local farmer. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, allow subscribers to connect directly with a farm and receive produce every week. Sloat's inviting Ala Khalil to sign up for a farm-to-clinic share through a local farm's CSA at a deep discount, $5 per week instead of $20. Khalil recently moved here from Jordan with her husband.
The farmers support us with the fruits and veggies, and we are supporting them because they are local and
Khalil's box will come from Mustard Seed Farm, about 25 minutes away. On a clear spring morning on the farm, Alice McGarry plants potatoes. She runs Mustard Seed with her husband and says she works on it full time, but she doesn't earn any money for her efforts.
So we are a farm that is not for profit. We are a service farm. And so a big part of our service is about food justice, and we just think that everyone should have really good food to eat.
That's where the clinic comes in. Including pregnant women and patients with diabetes in the CSA helps further the mission of getting fresh, nutritious food to anyone who wants it. People who can pay the full price and subsidize the others. McGarry says this arrangement actually attracts some paying customers.
On the marketing question, I think there are people that do join our CSA because of our mission.
Before the mid-1980s, there were no farms in this country offering CSAs. Now there are upwards of 5,000, so competition has gotten stiffer. Gone are the days of "you get what we've got" from farmers relying solely on easy-to-please subscribers. Still, Corey Bregendahl with the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture says we haven't maxed out the number of CSAs the Midwest can support.
Because of the maturation of the business model, I would say no. But in a pure CSA sense, I think the pure CSAs are gone because they were too limiting.
These days, some CSAs let you select what you get in the box, and many farms also market their produce wholesale. Others offer additional meat or eggs or dairy options. Here at Seven Pines Farm near Maxwell, Iowa, Dan Buyer is running a CSA business.
We do a lot of promoting for it and try to get it as big as we can get it.
Buyer's crops are certified organic, and he raises a small number of hogs, chickens, and lambs, which subscribers can buy to supplement their produce.
We have a personal chef that will create recipes for everything that's in the box. So when you get that kohlrabi or eggplant that you've never cooked before and don't know what to do with, she'll have a recipe for you to help you make something out of it.
Let's think about roasting radishes and maybe in a brown butter, and maybe if the tops are present, then you can saute the tops as well. And it's a fantastic side dish.
That's the chef, Holly Wiederin. As she sees it, the farmers give her a chance to help customers enjoy mealtime shows.
Their food becomes the star. I am just a supporting actor here.
Now that consumers can buy fresh local vegetables all over town, they can match their produce with their passion. A social mission, the luxury of a personal chef, or maybe just the convenience of the local grocery store. And back at primary healthcare, patients who can't pay a premium for local are also getting in on the bounty. Maris Bumgars is big and uncomfortable, many days past her due date with her first baby. She's signed up for the farm-to-clinic CSA. It's not that she doesn't buy vegetables.
I do, but usually I buy frozen because it's a little bit cheaper to buy it that way than it is to buy it fresh. So it would be really nice to be able to have fresh fruits and vegetables instead of just the frozen or canned.
And that's something any CSA farmer would be happy to hear. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from this reporter collective coming up in the second half of the show. We meet the tiny insect that plays an important role in waste management on Midwest farms.
So our mantra at Earth Eats is local ingredients with global flavor. And we're going to go there again. Today we're making a sag.
Chef Daniel Orr makes wonderful dishes for us. A couple today that use greens, which you might see a lot of these early days of the farmer's market. First up, sag. It's an Indian dish made from lots and lots of leafy veggies.
Now, most places in America use spinach because that's the simplest green. But in India, they have different sags for different times of the year. Today, we're going to use actually Mizuna, which is a Japanese mustard grain. So we're going to mix that with a little arugula and a little spinach so it has a nice balanced flavor. The mustard might be a little bit too aggressive, too strong. What I always do with aggressive flavors like dandelions and mustard grains, you add a touch of sweet, a touch of heat, and a touch of fat. I'm using what I call Purple Haze Mizuna, just because I like Jimi Hendrix, but so I've renamed it Purple Haze. Just pull off the leaves and leave the stem behind, so you just kind of like put two fingers together and pull it straight through there, and that removes the grains. All right, so we got a nice big hot pan. Okay, we're going to add some olive oil, garlic, ginger. I'm going to add the red onion, which is about two medium red onions, diced small. We're going to make this a little spicy, so we're adding jalapeno. Okay, they're throwing some arugula. Then we're going to throw in a handful of spinach. It's about 2 pounds of greens total. So this is a big mess of greens. But again, when you cook this, it will be about a quarter of that volume when we're done. Okay, I'm going to add a cup of cream, teaspoon and a half, 2 teaspoons of toasted cumin. And then we're going to sprinkle cornmeal. Anytime you cook greens, a lot of moisture comes out of them. And the cornmeal is going to absorb some of that moisture so you don't have a real soupy, watery greens dish.
You'll cook this for about 4 minutes, and then you could serve it just as is, or you could puree this to get a really smooth, sauce-like texture.
This isn't one of those dishes that you want to have the greens crispy and crunchy. It's more of, you know, you get that nice mouthfeel, kind of a velvety, creamy mouthfeel. And what I have is some paneer cheese. We've just warmed that up and served the sog right on top of it.
Paneer, oh, by the way, also really easy to make. We've got a tutorial from Robin Morton of the White Violet Center. Listen to her step-by-step instructions in the podcast archives at eartheats.org. Easiest way to find it, search for paneer.
Now, a lot of people think of pesto as being that classic basil pesto that's so famous in Italian cooking. Grind up the garlic and then work in the basil or the different herbs and then add some cheese and some pine nuts or walnuts until it became this really nice paste. But you can make pestos out of a lot of different things.
A different kitchen for our next greens recipe. This one is in Columbus, Indiana, and it happens to be about 10 paces away from the Orr family garden, which is massive and beautiful, and right now full of herbs.
Well, today I'm going to take some mint and do a mint pesto, which is going to have a little bit of an Asian-inspired flavor by adding some ginger to it. All right, so the best way to get started is to throw your garlic in there first. Garlic tends to take a little longer to puree than the rest, so if you add it towards the end, it might stay a little chunky and you'll get big pieces of it in there. I'm going to add a little bit of lemon zest. About a tablespoon of ginger. I'm going to add a half a jalapeno in here. And leave the seeds in. And I'm going to put in, you know, a good 3 or 4 cups of mint. And I've just pulled off the tops of the mint, so we don't have any real tough stems in here. All right, a little bit of salt and some oil. Now, I'm going to use some nice extra virgin olive oil in this. We're just going to puree this. And it's really just as simple as that.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that good?
Very tasty.
So you could throw that with pasta. You could make it into a salad dressing. A great thing to do with this also, just pour it into plastic containers or jars, put it in the freezer, and, you know, we'll keep for months in the freezer. Now, with a lot of traditional pestos, you do add some Parmesan cheese and nuts. Now, I've left this one completely vegan, and so there's a lot more uses for it. And then if you want to add the cheese, you can just add it at the time you're going to use it.
Both of these recipes at eartheats.org. Coming up, the difficulties setting up a food hub.
Because we're not there necessarily to start a food hub, but to figure out what is the infrastructure that's in the way of starting a food hub.
Back again with Stephanie Solomon and Michael Simmons of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. Now that the food charter has passed, what's standing in the way of a food hub in Bloomington? Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. U.S. livestock produce a lot of milk, a lot of meat, and a lot of manure. But some little-known insects can put that manure to good use. All they want in exchange is some good dung for dinner. For Harvest Public Media, Jacob Grace has more.
Okay, there we go. Here we go. Look at quite a few. See them?
It's a muggy spring afternoon in central Missouri, and farmer Ralph Foss is digging through a sloppy patch of cow poop with researcher Wayne Bailey.
Well, there's another one.
Voss has just found some of his farm's unseen workers, dung beetles.
An Aphodius femitarius, very common dung beetle all over the world. Wayne, help me. Quarter of an inch long, maybe?
I wouldn't have noticed the beetle if Foss hadn't pointed it out. It has a shiny black head and a tannish back and seems perfectly content to be crawling through fresh cow feces. This beetle survives, like all dung beetles, by sucking the juices out of fresh dung.
A lady from the University of Texas refers to cow pies as a dung beetle slurpee.
Dung beetles often collect fresh dung and bury it below the ground for their offspring to eat, and that can save farmers like Voss a lot of money. By getting manure in the ground, dung beetles increase grazing area, improve soil nutrients and water absorption, and even reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Most importantly, they prevent parasites and fly larvae from breeding in the dung.
So if you get dung beetles in sufficient numbers to suck all of the juice out of the pie, the fly eggs in that pie are going to perish. It's that simple.
Farmers like Voss have reason to be excited. It's been estimated that dung beetles save U.S. farmers hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But that number could be much larger. Dung beetles have been declining for decades, and it's partially thanks to the very farmers the beetles are helping out. Many farmers treat their livestock with drugs called wormers that kill parasites living in the livestock manure. But these wormers can hurt dung beetles, too. Here's Wayne Bailey, a researcher at the University of Missouri.
You know, I have my own farm that I lease out for cattle, and at this point in time, I can't find any dung beetles on my property because of the wormer they're using.
Bailey is spreading the word about less harmful ways to use wormers, but he also has bigger plans. Most of the dung beetles in the Midwest work too slowly to meet farmers' needs. Hardworking dung beetles in other parts of the U.S. can't survive the Midwest winters.
So we would like to try to build those populations that have adapted to the colder winters to build up in numbers and spread across the state.
That's why Bailey is starting a project to research and breed dung beetle species for Midwest farmers. He thinks that with a little help, dung beetles could join earthworms and honeybees as major contributors to Midwest agriculture.
What we really need is our dung beetle species that fill in the whole season.
Yeah, there has been talk of bringing in a lot of species.
That's Dr. Sean Whipple. He got his PhD studying dung beetles in Nebraska.
it's made a big difference in places like Australia. They brought over a bunch of species from Africa and Europe, North America.
Australia has been introducing exotic dung beetles for decades, where they've been credited with reducing huge fly and pest populations. But Whipple warns that non-native species could potentially drive off native dung beetles and reduce biodiversity.
You want to be careful anytime you bring in a non-native species into a habitat.
Some introductions have already taken place in the southern U.S. Farmer Ralph Voss dreams of seeing dung beetle numbers like those he's seen in Louisiana.
You just cannot believe how many dung beetles there are in southern Louisiana. Enormous numbers. They just devour cow pies. They just destroy them.
Voss is hoping that better dung beetles are on the way and that Midwest farmers like him will soon be getting some free waste management. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob Grace.
More stories from America's fields at harvestpublicmedia.org. We're at the Uptown Bar and Cafe with Brad Dunn. The menu here includes all your traditional cocktails.
You know, Manhattan, the Sazerac, French 75, and then we let our bartenders play.
Come up with new drinks, experiment with flavors. Brad created a drink he's calling the Coco Loco. It's mezcal infused with ancho chilies, creme de cacao, and blood orange juice. In fact, all the signature cocktails at Uptown this season feature tequilas and mezcals. It's a group of spirits that's becoming increasingly popular, according to Brad.
So agave is a cactus-like plant that grows in Mexico. They're enormous. They look like, imagine the top of a pineapple, but weighing hundreds of pounds. And agave distillates are, you think of tequila and mezcal. They're made in different regions and different styles. Mezcal typically is a little bit smokier because of the way they roast the agave plant. If anyone likes a really great scotch, one of those really smoky campfire style scotches, there's a ton of different mezcals that would probably knock your socks off. There's the Blanco, it's often called silver, and the Reposado, which means rested. And then the añejo, which means old. So the longer it's been, quote unquote, rested or aged in oak, same thing with whiskey and scotch and all these different things, and the same applies to wine. The longer it stays in oak, the darker it gets. It's a fun thing to look into.
Brad Dunn is the general manager at the Uptown Cafe. He talks about wine and spirits with us on occasion. Let me direct you to a recipe that uses tequila. It's not a beverage, but an adult fruit bowl. Watermelon and fresh berries in a tequila lime syrup. There's a special twist to this recipe that you really have to see. Find it in the recipe archives at eartheats.org. Michael Simmons and Stephanie Solomon were part of the committee that wrote Bloomington's food charter, which was unanimously approved by the city council last month. The idea for the charter started about 10 years ago with a lot of passionate people from different parts of the food system coming together. They formed the Bloomington Food Policy Council. As Simmons explains, in those first meetings, everyone had sticky notes, and they wrote ideas on those sticky notes that they felt were crucial to a just, efficient, and sustainable local food system. They then organized the notes into categories and labeled those categories.
And after that, I took all of those sticky notes home and plastered them all over the walls of my house and spent a long time looking at them and created the first draft of the charter based on those.
It was wonderful to see how many ideas people had in common.
Stephanie Solomon is also the director of education and outreach at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
And the different ways of talking about food and the different perspectives of folks in our community that were passionate about food. And that's what I love about the document is, I mean, really in each statement, there's so much to talk about. I feel really passionately about, you know, the first line, food security is a basic human right. And I think it's really meaningful that that's where we start.
The food charter is the vision for the local food system. The group agreed on every point included in the document.
For instance, when they started researching 10 years ago, they realized right away that getting more local, sustainably grown food into retail establishments would involve having a food hub. So there's a line in the charter that says just that. But details about how to accomplish that weren't included.
That's the interesting thing about the Food Policy Council, because we're not there necessarily to start a food hub, but to figure out what is the infrastructure that's in the way of starting a food hub so that we can work together as a community to affect policy that would allow us to have something like that.
Which means creating a food action plan. That'll outline specific tasks and create a timeline for implementing certain goals. Simmons says they hope to involve people from all parts of the community in the next steps, especially players from big retail stores like Walmart and maybe even Whole Foods.
Because one of the constraints that was mentioned to us was that the larger stores don't have the time to deal with multiple independent growers. But if they could deal with one distribution point for the produce of those growers, they would be much more likely to be able to include that in their inventory.
But I've heard talk of a food hub in this area for years. What's the difficulty getting this started?
Money, for one thing. It's a fairly pricey thing to do. One of the possibilities would be to repurpose an existing facility, and that would, I think, make it more financially possible.
And finding the organization that kind of is behind it. You know, we have a lot of different organizations addressing issues of, access to local food. But I've seen in other communities where there are food hubs, it might be the land-grant university or a larger kind of community hub, if you will, that that is, behind making that happen and doing the collaborating and creating the infrastructure. And I think that we haven't identified that. I don't feel like we've identified that in Bloomington and in our community.
Some members of the planning committee were invested in talking about a food hub, like Solomon. Others were interested in school gardening. Everyone came with their own areas of interest. Simmons was especially concerned about what happens at the end of the process, the waste created by a food system.
Overall, if we look at food systems across the United States and Canada, that's probably the most neglected part of the food system. There's a lot of interest in production and distribution, but there's less interest in what happens afterwards. So I think that's really essential that we address that, and that's a very important part of the food system itself.
So will we see the development of a curbside composting program in the city in the next few years? What about that food hub? Simmons and Solomon are hopeful, but of course it all depends on that food action plan. We'll keep following the work of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. Listen to previous interviews about how to affect change in your local food system at eartheats.org. And subscribe to our weekly show on iTunes so you don't miss a single thing from Earth Eats. Shout out to our dedicated group, Avon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Betsy Shepard, Daniel Orr, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. BloomingFoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Springtime, go enjoy it. All the best from Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.